Hello, this is Christopher Bolin. Today I'm doing an interview with author Jack Monette, PhD, a Mormon author, and author of an extraordinary new book called Awakening to Our Awful Situation, Warnings from the Nephite Prophets. And today we're going to discuss the material in his book, which is prophetic and very relevant. Jack, are you there?
I am here.
Jack, could you give us a little idea of who you are? I haven't met you. Could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I can. I do have a PhD in educational history, which is a little bit away from this, but I've had a great interest in history in general and current events. My background has been in both book publishing and in education, teaching on the college level, the university level.
Did you teach at BYU or?
No, I didn't teach at BYU. I did direct, the LDS Church has what's called an institute program, and I directed that at the University of Hawaii, and then did some administrative work for Eastern Arizona College, in Arizona, of course.
I see that you wrote, two books on, public schools and education. You wrote one, John Taylor Educator in 2002. And Revealed Educational Principles and the Public Schools in 1998.
Yes, those were books mainly an outgrowth of my dissertation that I did at the University of Utah on the LDS education system. And it was it's quite interesting, to me at least. I didn't think others would be interested, but it's proved otherwise since. In writing Revealed Educational Principles in the Public Schools, we showed that in the LDS Church, the Mormon Church, that those leaders of the early church were very opposed to public schooling. They were concerned about what would happen with government schools and government control of curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very prescient, very prescient. Now you've come out, I think in November this book came out, with this very extraordinary book, Awakening to Our Awful Situation. And this book came out in November of last year, didn't it? And it's taken off, from what I understand, it's just taken off like a wildfire.
It is selling very well. Actually, the first day of distribution was December the 4th, and we've sold just over 3,000 copies at this point, in which, considering that we're working through independent distributors and on the Internet, we feel very comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Now, the book is printed in Heber City in Utah. Yes. And the book is written clearly from a Mormon point of view. I'm not a Mormon. You are a Mormon, I gather.
I am. Uh-huh.
And the book comes with a very good DVD by Dr. Stephen E. Jones. And it's a two-hour speech that Professor Jones gave, 9/11 Revisited, Scientific and Ethical Questions, on February of 2006 at Utah Valley State College in Orem, Utah.
Mm-hmm.
How did you and Professor Jones come to work together on this?
You know, I'd never met Steve prior to writing this, and as I did a chapter on 9/11, I thought, this is senseless. I'm doing all the work here, and here's a man just south of me, about 50 miles, who's done a great deal of work. And so I went to his office at BYU. And at that time, he was under some, criticism there for having talked about Twin Towers and the possible problems there in Twin Towers in the original story that we received. Mm-hmm. And as we did talk about it, he was very excited about the book and things that I was writing about. And I asked him at the time, I said, Steve, by the way, how are you accepted here? And he paused for a minute and he said, among those who read very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought about that several times. It seems like those who do read, those who have an interest in what's going on, really understand more of what's going on rather than taking the party line, if you will, or the 10 o'clock news.
Right. Well, that's very clear. I mean, certainly those who get their information from television or the mainstream media are at a disadvantage. Now, before we go in, I want to tell the listeners that this book, Awakening to Our Awful Situation, deals with some concepts that are particular to the Mormon Church. One is the concept of the Gadians and robbers. Another one that's very important is the concept of secret combinations. And if you could just tell us a little bit, what are the Getty Anton robbers and secret combinations?
If I could first, Christopher, just give a slight background here to help you understand the theology involved. Mormons believe that there is a premortal existence prior to coming to this earth, that we were in a place with our Father in heaven, and all the spirits that came to this earth were here. But at that time, there was what's called a war in heaven. The book of Revelation talks about that. And it says that one-third of the host of heaven were cast out. They had followed Satan rather than God. And Mormon scripture elucidates on that a little bit. Could I read a little bit to you just to get a feeling of where we are?
By all means.
You know, I say that, and then, of course, I haven't got my finger on it, which doesn't help. I guess you're going to pass.
Well, I can help you with this one little bit that you have at the beginning of chapter 2.
Okay.
Let me read this part. This is very important. It says, "Wherefore, O ye Gentiles, it is wisdom in God that these things should be shown unto you, that thereby ye may repent of your sins and suffer not that these murderous combinations shall get above you, which are built up to get power and gain. And the work, yea, even the work of destruction come upon you, yea, even the sword of the justice of the eternal God shall fall upon you, to your overthrow and destruction, if ye shall suffer these things to be." And he goes on, this is in Ether, it says, "Wherefore the Lord commandeth you, when ye shall see these things come among you, that ye shall awake to the sense of your awful situation, because of this secret combination which shall be among you, or woe be unto it, because of the blood of them who have been slain. For they cry from the dust for vengeance upon it, and also upon those who built it up." Boy, when I read those words, I think about the dust of September 11th and the 3,000 dead people and all of the lies we've been told about what happened on 9-1-1. And, you know, about a year ago, I went out to see Professor Jones in Provo, and it was a snowy day like today. And I asked him, "Professor Jones, can you tell me, is there something in your faith that has given you the courage to buck the trend, to challenge the official version? And as a tenured professor, you know, to come out and question the official version." And he, you know what he did? He gave me, he had a Book of Mormon there, and he gave me his personal copy of the Book of Mormon, where he had highlighted exactly that part that I just read to you. And he said that as Mormons, we are aware that there would come a time when these secret combinations, these conspiratorial groups, would take over the power of the government completely, and then they would bring this, you know, this destruction onto the nation. Precisely what we're seeing now.
Right, right.
And he said that we're commanded as Mormons who read to do something about it.
Right. Right. In fact, the scripture, as you read the book, I think, says that we should waste and wear out our lives and bring into light the hidden things of darkness.
Exactly.
Which is very, very aptly said, I think, but again, a very difficult thing to do in many cases.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that Eric and Eric Hushmid, who's helping us produce this show today, and myself, I've wasted a lot of time or a lot of energy. I wouldn't say it's wasted, but I spent a lot of time and energy, and so has he, in the past 5 years, you know, digging into the darkness of 9-1-1. And I wanted to say, there's your book has it seems to be written very well for the layman, and it introduces all of these key concepts like control of the media and the necessity for a reader or the public to have factual, correct information. Can you say something about that, about how that if a person doesn't have correct information, they lose agency, as you say?
Yeah, and what you're coming to is what I started out with, and I won't go into everything there, but agency becomes the primary thing, I think.
Yeah.
For us to act, we need to know. We need to know all sides. And obviously, if we're getting a diluted news source or if we're getting a thwarted news source, and in some sense here where we aren't getting the full information, obviously we can't make correct decisions. And we say, you know, when we talk about Satan and his thrust in that premortal existence was to destroy the agency of man. And then we look at other Mormon scripture that talks about the Constitution. And we realize the Constitution of our country was written to ensure agency, that we'd always be able to make decisions, free decisions. And that, I think, is what we're seeing taken from us a great deal over time. You mentioned the news media. And obviously, if the news media reports half a story, we don't have the full information. Therefore, we really don't have true agency because we can't make informed decisions. And that goes to so many things. There's a chapter on education, as you're aware, and manipulating the curriculum. If you do that, if students grow up learning, thinking they know the truth and know the whole story, but they only know part of the story, they will not really grow up to be good, informed citizens to make correct decisions.
Right. Now, so these secret combinations that are working, conspiring, and taking control of the government, are the Gaddy Anton robbers, is that the name of a group from the Book of Moroni or Book of Mormon that did this secret combination in the past?
Yeah, as you read from Ether, that was Moroni, who was the last prophet, and he had gone through first discussing a people called the Jaredites, people who had come to America in 2200 B.C. at the Tower of Babel.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been destroyed by secret combinations. They had brought over the forms, the oaths, the covenants, and so forth,
mm-hmm.
that really, as we learn in the Book of Mormon and other places, were inspired from the days of Cain and Abel, or Cain mm-hmm. and Satan when he made his pact. And so Moroni goes on to say they are had among all people. And so there's nothing unique or singular in the Book of Mormon experience, except that it's outlined very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have that with the Jaredites, the first civilization, then you have the Nephites, which is the second civilization that went from 400 B.C. to or 600 B.C. to 400 A.D., who also are destroyed by those same secret combinations. Combination's an interesting word, and I think your listeners will understand that, but sometimes it's easier if we go back to recognizing the Book of Mormon is written in 1830. You go back to the 1828 Webster's Dictionary, and the parallel word with that is conspiracy.
Exactly.
And so if we need to say secret conspiracy, if that becomes easier to understand, then we can use that instead.
Exactly. Now, the thing is that when we then fast forward, you have a chapter here that is, I think, the first chapter I dove into in your book called Gaddy Antons in Real Time. And I went there because I was familiar with the Gaddy Anton robbers and what they're all about. And I wanted to see. And this chapter is fascinating because you dive right into the, what would we call it, the Iran-Contra Clinton-Bush drug smuggling operations going back even to the Vietnam War, and particularly the importation of large amounts of cocaine through MENA, Arkansas, and the exchange of weapons and money and all of that. And what you do is that you name names. You name the people who are directly involved, and many of these people are, you know, in high government positions today. I know you mentioned that Richard Armitage, that big hulk of a guy who threatens people with his bare hands across the table, as being involved in the drug smuggling from Bangkok or from Asia in the late 1970s.
Yeah,
and you also point out, you know, many people who are directly involved in the government today. This seems to me that this book is red hot.
It's unpolitically correct, isn't it?
I would guess so. You have on the bottom of page 274, you talk about Robert M. Gates, the former deputy director of the CIA, and former director of the CIA, who is now, if I'm not mistaken, he is the Secretary of Defense.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this is the man
who's... Same names keep coming up over and over again, don't they?
Well, that's the amazing thing, is that when we're talking about these Gaddy Anton robbers in real time today, in your opinion, how large of a group are we talking about?
You know, I don't know. And, of course, we go back to that word secret combination, secret conspiracy. And that shrouds a great deal of evidence. All we have are things that are taking place after the fact that we can look at, and we can say who was involved in these things, what happened, and what did it promote, where did it go, and begin to put, as people say, connect the dots, begin to put things together. I like Joel Skousen, and you're aware he wrote the foreword to the book.
Yeah.
And he made the statement, he said, well, thus, while we'll never have absolute proof of this great conspiracy to take down liberty and national sovereignty, we have enough evidence from hundreds of whistleblowers many dead, some yet living, to sense that this threat is real and to begin to take effective action. Well, that's really where we are. We're looking at putting things after the fact. So how many people are involved? I don't think we know. Who is involved? I'm not sure that we know. We know some levels because we see the same players out there doing the same things that seem to destroy our sovereignty.
Now, I want to ask you something. I'm not familiar with Joel Skousen, but I have done a lot of research on 911 and the war in Iraq and things of that nature.
By the way, I use your research for some of my work, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And, yeah, I see that you quoted Eric Hoopschmidt in here, and you cited me once, too. And I have some of my articles, my recent articles and other articles are posted on IamTheWitness.com under my name. And my wife was looking at that today, and she was, and I have many pictures there of people who are involved in some key aspect of 9/11, whether it's the court process that followed, in which there hasn't been a single trial in 5 years for any of the victims of 9/11 who lost loved ones. The people who covered up the non-investigation, I should say, people like Michael Chertoff, who was the Assistant Attorney General, or there's a host of some Israeli actors and American actors who are supportive of the State of Israel. So my general discovery of 9/11 in the past 3 or 4 years has found a lot of Zionists. Not the same Zion as you referred to, and maybe not the same Zion as you referred to in your church, but people that are connected to the State of Israel seem to have played a disproportionately large role in the events of 9/11.
And I would argue with you on Christopher, intentionally I didn't go there in the book. I wanted to make this palatable for everyone, and of course that becomes a trigger issue, and so I selected to stay away from that issue because there is enough other evidence that we could point to showing there was a problem.
Right. Now, that's very interesting because, you know, Professor Jones was interviewed on a radio in Salt Lake City on September 6th of last year. And although Professor Jones has done amazing research on the molten metal that was found at the World Trade Center and the unexplained collapse of Building 7 and things of that nature, The person on the radio, Doug Fabrizio from Public Radio, he really prodded Professor Jones, I thought rather unfairly, to speak out about who he thought was behind 9/11. Who was behind it? He repeated the question once or twice. And although your book wasn't available at the time, Professor Jones said, well, you know, some scholars like Webster Tarpley had pointed to this international banking cartel. Now, I want to ask you, because in your book, you do point out also, I think in Wars and Rumors of Wars and Secret Combinations, that this the Rothschild family and other very large banking families, international banking families, have played a significant role in the creation of something called the Council of on Foreign Relations, the CFR. In your opinion, is the CFR... does that have the characteristics of a secret combination?
I think that it does, but I think that's a very large body. I would assume there would be a very small cabal there that would be directing or giving the real message there or doing the actual homework and putting things together as a direction where they would go. The CFR then becomes the body that seems to put that into effect, into practice. And the CFR, as I understand, is what, over 3,000 people?
Right.
And that, to me, is too large of a body to be called a secret combination. You can't be too secret with 3,000 people.
Right. But the way that these secret combinations seem to work, I couldn't find the quote here, but it's like you say, there's these very powerful people at the top, and they create these organizations like CFR, like Bilderberg, like Trilateral. And then these organizations become ways that they can influence and get consensus and get people to go along with their plans. And they also provide a good pool for recruiting people when you find somebody who's willing to be an agent for your group.
Yeah, I would agree with that. We have enough statements by those who are in a position to know. David Rockefeller, as you're aware, has admitted very openly that he's proud of what he's done, and he has listed things that you and I might call subversive.
Yeah.
We get into Carol Quigley's work or Cleon Skousen's work, mm-hmm. other individuals who have actually gone back to naming names and saying, okay, we can't say everything these have done, and we can't go too deep into it, but we do know these people are doing things, and this seems to be the drive they have. And so we get into specific individuals, and I'm not sure we need to do it at this point. Anybody can go on the web and find lists and lists.
Mm-hmm.
We would have to go back, I think, with the international bankers initially, and you go back to, that always goes back to the Rothschild family and then develops from that point out. And we see the links that that family has forged with other bankers and so forth. And we, knowing from our history, looking at the Federal Reserve Act,
mm-hmm.
looking at various things that have been done, all the J.P. Morgan work and such, that really has had an effect on our nation, looking at the involvement in wars. We can normally go back to those groups or those people, those families, as being very instrumental in getting us involved in a global level, which really hasn't been to our advantage by any means.
Right. Right. Now, the thing is that when you provide this information in this book, which is very, very accessible to the average reader, you make these points, these rather complicated points, seem very simple. And when people become aware, when people really become aware and awaken to our awful situation, what is one to do?
You know, that's the question I get over and over again. I had, had a man just yesterday came to me saying, I love your book, but I hate your answers. You don't have any. And I'm afraid that's really true. What we do say is stay close to the Spirit. And Joseph Smith, if I can go back to a little theology here,
mm-hmm.
Joseph Smith made a statement one time, and he said the first key to salvation is knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Without knowledge, you have nothing. And this really becomes the first step, at least an awakening here. Awake to the fact there's information out there that you haven't got. Once you have that knowledge, then you're ready perhaps for the second step. But this book is a first-step book.
Right. You have a quote here from President Ezra Taft Benson. I guess he was the president of the church?
He was president of the church, and of course also he was in the Eisenhower administration as Secretary of Agriculture.
Okay, you have this quote, and Ezra Taft Benson said, "Our civilization and our people are seemingly afraid to be revolutionary. We are too broad-minded to challenge what we do not believe in. We are afraid of being intolerant, uncouth, ungentlemanly. We have become lukewarm in our beliefs." That's a very key thing, I think, because my understanding of the Mormon Church is that you have this information. You are commanded to do something about it when you find these secret combinations at work. But at the same time, most Mormons are very comfortable, very mainstream, and not very, they're not likely to be revolutionaries. How do we square that circle?
And I'm not sure. You've pinpointed some things that I found to be true. As I've met with groups throughout the state of Utah here over the last month, we found many similar things. People say, gee, I believe this, I know this is true, but when I talk to my neighbor, he says, you're a conspiracy nut.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think that's peculiar to Utah or to the Mormon Church. I think that's a phenomenon that goes on throughout our nation. But you're right. As members of the LDS Church, having the scriptures we do, I personally think that we need to be more involved. However, I can't act for others. And, of course, what I say here in the disclaimer is that these are one man's musings.
But I want to ask you something. It's that when you provide many quotes from former presidents of the church,
mm-hmm.
and these quotes all point to the need for correct information, for the need for freedom, for national sovereignty, for it seems to me that the leaders of your church are extremely astute about the political dimension they're living in, whereas, for example, I grew up an Episcopalian, which is not unlike the Catholic Church, where there is virtually no discussion of any of these issues at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Does the Mormon Church, are they getting effectively two messages? Are they getting one message that says to obey the government and give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and at the same time, the ones that read a little bit more deeply are getting this information that there is a criminal conspiracy at work at the highest levels of our government, and we have to do something about it.
I think to a large extent that's true. Remember, the LDS Church now has 10 million members, and because of that, you have to gear things in a very open, a broad level there. And there will be people who will come into our church, and they may be very excited about these constitutional things we're talking about. But the main message of the church is the atonement of Jesus Christ and the restoration of the church in the latter days. As far as doctrines of the church, that's up to the individual to go ahead and read scriptures. And he's not told what to believe in the scriptures. He said, here are the scriptures. You make it a matter of prayer, and it'll be unfolded to you again by the Holy Spirit. It's not a matter of the church saying, this is what this says, therefore do this.
Right, right.
And the church will never take control of an individual like that.
Right. Now, but the thing is that when we have these secret combinations, this conspiratorial criminal network who's running our country, you know, this is the biggest country in the world in terms of some strength and power, and, you know, it's a very significant country. For this secret combination or this conspiratorial group to have taken control of our power, of this nation, of, you know, the media and the government and the judiciary, is this the same across the world? Has this same group taken control of most of the world?
Well, I think to a large extent, as we look at European Union, we see much of the same things taking place that have taken place here. We don't see it so much in the third world countries. However, we do see in the third world countries. I lived in China for a while, as my book explains there, and I couldn't believe how many IMF trucks there were driving around, indicating they had a great play in things that were taking place there. We know in the former Soviet Union, there's a great deal taking place there, which seems to be in league with many other nations, and I would think so. We look at the Bolshevik Revolution, the history of Russia, and we find those same families involved that we discussed earlier. So yes, I would say it's an international thing.
Now, when freedoms are lost, that chapter you have on page 309, you write something very interesting. I highlighted it. It said, unfortunately, because we are sometimes negligent in fulfilling responsibilities, and because we lack the power to control the ballot box, losses to our agency and freedoms that we take for granted are frequently lost. The inalienable rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, many of which are clearly defined in the Bill of Rights, have been abrogated. Is there any way to get them back? And what I thought was most interesting is that you say, because we lack the power to control the ballot box. I don't know if you're aware of my writings about this, but I specifically point to the fact that we no longer count our votes openly.
Right.
We've lost the so-called democratic franchise that we had in this republic.
That's
so
right.
That now the
right.
counting
right.
is done by computer companies. We have no idea who wins any elections.
That's right. Yeah.
And
tragic, isn't it?
Yeah, well, following from that, if there's a criminal gang running these computers and hacking into the computers and writing malicious code, what have you, well, it stands to reason if they're criminals that they're going to advance other criminals as candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So that what I've been saying for years is that we live in a crimocracy because we do not have free elections and we don't have free press. Don't you think that if we were simply to return to open, transparent elections in which the local people could see their votes being counted and we can have really authentic elections, that we could at least slow down these Gadianton robbers?
I think that's true. Don't forget, though, we have a tremendous amount of educational control, government education control, and media control, which becomes very hard to overcome. As far as the ballot boxes are concerned, by all means, I mean, that's the travesty, I think, of our times. And I should have had a chapter on that. I didn't know where to quit, so I put that one out. But by all, that could be a volume two very easily all in itself.
You bring up about four or five major sagas, if you will, things that have happened. You have an extremely good chapter on this Arkansas drug smuggling with the Clintons and the Bushes and all of that. And then you have part two, where you talk about the Oklahoma bombing, which you provide information which clearly shows that there's something other than a truck bomb did to damage that building. Then you have chapter 12 on September 11th. and you finish up with the war on Iraq. I wanted to ask you about September 11th. Do you think that the American people have been deliberately deceived by the mainstream media about what really happened that day?
You know, I would have to say so. I'm not sure that... Well, I do. I would say it was intentional. Again, we have so many people involved in the media, the owners of companies and so forth. You mentioned CFR earlier. CFR has a great deal to do with media control. And, of course, we'd have to go back to who directs CFR. And I think we'd have to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a closed media in that sense. We find that Steve Jones, for example, who we were talking about, has been ridiculed in many cases, or he's been misquoted, or he's been simply hasn't given the story that he has presented, and so he's been mocked in that sense. And I think others, Eric, I know, has an occasion or two. I've seen some things against him and what he said and what you said. I think anyone who speaks out is really asking for a slap in the face. But you know, to get back to your original question, have we been manipulated by media in that? I think by all means we have, and to get people to understand, what do you do? The press, although it's not really a free press, the press is about the only way we can get things in hands of others.
Right, right. You know, CNN the other day came out all the way from New York to interview me.
Right.
They interviewed me for about 2 hours, and they only put in about 30 seconds of what I said.
Uh-huh.
But I took that approach like you did, you know, when these big media concerns try to reach me and talk about 9/11, I know they're trying to give me some rope to hang myself with.
Yes.
And so you have to be very careful what you say, because they did exactly what they did to Professor Jones. They weren't interested. I had printed out $12 worth of photographs for them to look at, the molten metal and various aspects of 9/11. They weren't interested in seeing any of the evidence. They wanted to have me say something. And, you know, they took it back to New York and cut and pasted, and they asked me if I was an anti-Semite, and I said, no, of course not. I said, but this is usually what is charged. This is usually the charge that's leveled against critics of the Zionist policies. And then they put a woman from the ADL, and she said, well, that's what they all say. You know, I mean, it's amazing what the media does. But, you know, you've got to try and reach the people with the facts. And the American people, from what I've read, simply don't have the facts.
Right, right.
Something like, I think I might have read in your book, something like 60% or 80% of the American soldiers in Iraq think that they're there because of September 11th and Iraqi involvement in September 11th.
Yeah, yeah. Very misinformed, aren't we, as a people?
I mean, we're tragically misinformed. And now this president is asking for a quarter of $1 trillion to fight these wars, which are clearly illegal and ill-advised wars. What are we to do? I mean, is it something to protest wars? Are these the kinds of things that Mormons would do? Is there anything that they would do as a group just to try and stop this destruction?
And I'm not sure you'd ever see an orchestrated movement led by the church to do something like that. Instead, you would have individuals within the church who may come together and say, look, it says this, let's do this.
Right.
And so, you know, we do have various movements that do begin within the church. For example, National Center for Constitutional Studies.
Right.
You're probably aware of them. That was a Cleon Skousen that put that together. And again, that was the LDS Church. Not the church per se, but he as a member of the church put that together. And, of course, that's still going very strong. And other movements of that nature. And I think that's the kind of thing you'd see.
But look at you had this red hot guy, Professor Stephen Jones, coming out with his scientific understanding and evidence that thermite was used in the World Trade Center to cut down the three towers that fell that day.
Right.
He's a very scientific man. He was a tenured professor at BYU, Brigham Young University, the school that is owned and operated by the Church of Latter-day Saints. And yet, you know, he was, when he was snared on a radio show, on a hostile radio show, and accused of being an anti-Semite, the church actually suspended him. And what I was told, I know he was suspended from teaching, he was allowed to continue with his work, he still got a paycheck, but then I heard from a source in Utah that you know, he was on the suspended thing, and BYU was going to do an expert peer review type review of his thesis, and then decide whether his thesis was valid or not valid. And we were all waiting for that. All of us 9/11 researchers were waiting for that, you know. And then President Bush traveled out there to give a speech in support of Orrin Hatch, I believe it was, before the last election, probably in October. And a week later, the church apparently gave Professor Jones a retirement package that basically he accepted and retired as a teacher after 21 years. Now, I have to ask about that. You know, that the President of the United States met with the President of the Mormon Church in Salt Lake City, and a week later, the modern-day Galileo, the Socrates of our times, is given a golden parachute retirement package.
Yeah.
And effectively silenced, or he's taken away from his podium.
I think that doesn't seem right. Many people have read into that, again, Bush's trip here and so forth, and
uh-huh.
In conjunction with that. In reality, as Steve and I have talked about that, the problem was Steve was talking about Twin Towers and talking about problems. Of course, when you do that, people automatically in a lecture like that say, well, then who did it?
Mm-hmm.
And Steve would try to skirt the issue, and of course he has his own personal beliefs, but you don't want to say those. Yeah. The problem now is that Steve is employed by Brigham Young University, which is an entity of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Right.
The church itself has refused to take any kind of official position. And so here's Steve, who becomes, not intentionally, but becomes a spokesman as many perceive him because of his employment. And that was
right.
The reason, again, that he had to be, not had to be, I shouldn't put it that way, he had his choice to stay at BYU. He said he would rather be free to talk about what he wanted to say. And with that, again, they did give him a retirement package. He since secured other employment with another university, making just as much money. He's tickled pink because he said,
right.
Now I can say what I want to say, and
right.
People don't perceive that I'm speaking for the church, but speaking for Steve Jones.
Right, right. But I was disappointed all the same because, you know, that got BYU off the hook, and BYU right away said as soon as Professor Jones accepted this retirement package, they said, well, now the review will not go ahead. And you know, the review or Professor Jones' thesis is the football in this case, you know, and the ball was dropped and it's not going anywhere. We want to see, I would like to see those people who challenged his thesis to follow up on what they said. And if they think that his science is lacking in any way, to prove it, you know, basically to put up or shut up.
That doesn't have to be done through BYU, however. Anyone
right.
can do that. Any university, any scholarly group can get together and challenge it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there are many who disagree with him. And Steve allows for that. You know, there might be other answers, too. As
are
Steve
you,
looked at it, he said, that's what I believe. And I tend to go along with him personally.
Are you saying that, I mean, Professor Jones could have said, like what I say, when they ask me who did it, I say that 9/11 is an unsolved crime. I said, I wish I knew who did it. I don't, you know. But we that doesn't mean that our evidence that, you know, a crime was committed and it's not what the government says is any less valid. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Read my book. That's where I end the chapter on 9/11. We just don't know. There's a lot of information there that indicates somebody's lying to us. But we
yeah.
really don't know who the perpetrators were or exactly what the reasons were. We can see many of the results. We can see our war, the warlike nation that we've come to. And we can say, yes, these are direct results of 9/11. We can see some money that the various individuals made along the way. And by the way, I appreciate your work on that, too. But we don't really have all the answers. We have enough circumstantial answers that
yeah.
we can say something's wrong here.
But are you saying that Professor Jones with his courage and with his groundbreaking research was in effect an embarrassment to the church?
I would never say that, and he's not an embarrassment at BYU.
No.
Frankly,
but
yeah, he still has his office there.
But his position put the church somehow at odds with the government.
It could have by people perceiving that he was a spokesman for the church by his employment.
Okay. Thank you. I found that quote that you, or that sampling that you have in your book about the Iraq War, and you say that a sampling of 944 U.S. military respondents in Iraq, taken in the early months of 2006, showed that nearly 90% think the war in Iraq is in retaliation for Saddam's role in 9/11.
And I think a recent poll has shown that that is finally going down, that servicemen are realizing there is no connection. But initially, that seemed to be the direction.
Can you believe it? You know, but that's absolutely pathetic, you know, that people would give their lives, give their sons and daughters, husbands and wives, mothers and fathers in many cases, and these people are being sent off to a far war in Iraq on completely false pretenses.
I couldn't agree with you more.
But you know,
and yet we call them patriots. We say support our troops. And
yeah.
you're a terrible person if you say don't support the troops. And I would say yes, support the troops by all means. Question why they're there.
Yeah, yeah. Now there's another thing you say in here about information and that you know disinformation and bad information likes to attach itself to solid research. And you also say someplace in here that a incorrect information or incomplete information is the most effective lie.
Mm-hmm.
And about 9/11, I wanted to ask you that. You know, 9/11 is a massive criminal. I mean, it's a horrendous crime. It was clearly thought through long in advance, and many people are involved in it. Yet the American people, as you point out in here, for example, Lee Hamilton on the 9/11 Commission clearly stated that in the 9/11 Commission they weren't looking to assign blame. So that 9/11 remains an uninvestigated crime.
Mm-hmm.
Except for whatever the FBI did or didn't do.
Isn't that something that commission and most people, if you'll ask them about the commission, they assumed, and the man on the street says, well, that solved the problem. They looked at things, they know the answers, because they were the specialists that got into it. And when you look at the motive behind the 9/11 commission to not do any of that at all, it's preposterous. You're right. Why haven't there been an investigation?
Right.
And
right.
That was never intended to be an investigation.
Right, right. Well, you know, I've seen this before. That's what they often do with these so-called final studies, these final reports. They give you a million pages of data. A lot of it's incomplete. And then but the final commission that does the research, that puts it all together for the public, never is looking to assign any blame. So it's like, we'll talk about 9/11. We'll talk about what we're going to do in the future to prevent 9/11, but we're not going to assign blame. And as we know, some of the key players in 9/11, like the passenger screening company at Boston Logan Airport and at Newark Airport that day, was Huntley USA, which is owned by an Israeli company which is headed by a co-defendant of Ehud Olmert, the current Israeli Prime Minister. This company, which obviously failed to stop these men getting on the plane or put these men on the plane or gave out fabricated evidence, this company has been shielded from any accountability in a U.S. court by an act of Congress.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, as you're well aware, you think you more than almost anyone, it's not just them. In so many cases, we have so many who were involved who have been completely shielded. In fact, when you look at... You look at the 19 original people that were named.
Yeah.
Not a single one of them brought to or had charges pressed against him.
Yeah.
You continue with all of the things that took place that day, and no one has suffered any liability or blame for anything that took place.
But
look at the military itself and the fact that the jets weren't scrambled.
Yes.
And even the military has refused to penalize anyone who should have been doing their job.
Yes,
it's horrendous.
Yes, but now in the past 5 years, then the nation and the world has been left to interpret the events of 9/11. So then we come out with all of these various groups and researchers like myself and compilers of information and interpreters of information. Now, doesn't it stand to reason though that in such a massive crime like this, that there would be a great effort by the perpetrators of the crime to confuse the issue and to put out disinformation about the issue?
I think you're absolutely right.
So, yeah, you would advise then that the person, any reader or researcher of 9/11, be skeptical and look at the sources and just I mean, how does one decide what is factual, what is correct information in this day and age with the Internet? How does one decide what is correct information?
You know, I think what you're saying, it would go with the Kennedy assassination. Look at all the different things that have begun with that. And you talk about misinformation and taking us off in different leads every direction.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's so many different things out there, there's assassination, RFK is more of the same.
Right.
And there's just, it's hard at this point because of all the disinformation to isolate what might be correct information.
Right.
We would say, and I would say to members of my church, as well as any God-fearing individual, I would say, listen to the Spirit. And that's frankly about where we are.
Right. That's very good. Tell me, Joel Skousen wrote the foreword to this book.
Mm-hmm.
Who's Joel Skousen? How did you get in touch with him?
Joel writes World Affairs Brief. He has, and that's on the web. It's a weekly newsletter that comes out. Excellent. If you haven't got it, I encourage most people to subscribe or to at least look at his webpage, Joel Skousen.
And he's also from a good Mormon family, right?
He is. But he's been the president of the Conservative Caucus back in Washington, D.C. for quite a while. Has a tremendous background. And Joel and I have been friends. We've worked on various committees over the years. And so when this came up, when I began to write this, I did go to him. And frankly, at the end of every third or fourth chapter, I'd say, hey, Joel, what do you think of this? In fact, you mentioned the Gadientans in real time. That was a chapter I didn't want to have in there.
Really?
Oh, it tore my heart out because, of course, it's all blood and guts.
Yeah.
It's all the secret murders and so forth.
And the secret murders. Thanks for bringing me – that's so important. You point out – you even name the names of the 12 bodyguards of Bill Clinton who died mysterious deaths shortly afterwards.
Of course, I got that off the web. Anybody can go there and get it. Terry Reid, in his book, Compromised, kept referring over and over again to the 42 deaths around Bill Clinton.
Right.
And I think that's that should be common knowledge, although I found a number of people come to me afterwards saying, how do you know that? How can you say that? But there's so many sources, it's pretty hard to hide it.
But you pull it together, you see, and that's the thing is that, you know, this is the Bush-Clinton cabal or this team, and now we're looking at a possibility that Mrs. Clinton will become president in 2008, and we'll have, you know, the better part of a quarter of a century being run by, you know, people who are demonstrably of criminal backgrounds.
And yet, as much as I despise the Clintons, and that's a personal thing. You don't have to have to quote me on that.
Yeah.
But as much as I dislike the presidency under Bill Clinton and the foreboding of the possible presidency of Hillary is tragic, I think. But you know, at least we question them. We don't question Mr. Bush right now.
Right.
And that bothers me even more.
Right. Well, tell me, I want to tell you that this is an excellent book. How can the listener, how can they get a copy of this? How can they get a copy of Awakening to Our Awful Situation?
If you're talking a nationwide distribution, we have none. You'd have to get in touch with me personally on that. I'll be happy to give you my email address, and feel free to contact me. We're selling the books now for $12.95. We ask for $2 shipping to go with it, making a total of $14.95.
That's very fair. What's your email?
My email address is jack@monettbooks, and that's monettbooks.com.
Okay. You don't have a website yet, though?
We don't.
Okay.
Although I found, and I'm not sure we'll even have one at this point, I punched in on the web there on Google and put in Awakening to Our Awful Situation. I find four or five pages of it, so there are enough other stores that do handle it on the web.
And as you said, this book is selling like hotcakes in Utah, huh?
You know, it is right now, much to our surprise.
Well, that's great, because I can tell you, this is one book that I really highly recommend. It was sent to me by Barbara Jean Whiteley, born on the 4th of July from Utah. And I see Stephen Jones also, of course, highly recommends this book. I want to thank you very much for your time today, and good luck with your book.
Well, thank you very much, Christopher. It's been very enjoyable talking to you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Jack.